session number 10589, Reel 1.
Mr. Gillard, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, when it was and how it was that you joined the BBC?
Well, I was a schoolmaster, and in the 30s, I began that career in 1932, just at the time of a great national economic depression, which was so severe that all individuals holding public positions, even school teachers and so on, had to take a 10% cut in salary. And I was teaching in a boarding school where I was on the bottom of the Burnham scale for a university graduate and getting £234 a year, less income tax, which brought it down to about 200 or something. And the school levied a charge of 120 a year on me for room and board in term time. So I had £80 a year in which to support myself for the 4 months of the year, school holidays, plus general pocket money. It wasn't enough. And I began looking round for ways and means of augmenting this income. And it occurred to me, rather at random, that if I could in fact persuade the BBC to allow me to do school broadcasting, I could do more or less on the air what I was doing already in my own classrooms and in my own laboratory, because I was a science man. And that there wouldn't be a great deal of effort involved in it, and that I would get a bit of money. So I began ingratiating myself with the school broadcasting people, going to their conferences and their weekend affairs and so forth. And I didn't push myself too much, but it worked. And in no time at all, I found myself doing school broadcasts, and my school was only too pleased for me to do it because it brought a certain amount of reflected glory, I suppose, on the school. Anyway, there was no objection to it. So by the mid-30s, or shortly after that, I was a fairly regular freelance broadcaster, because once you start doing it for schools, you know, once you get your foot inside the door, so to speak, all sorts of other departments get on to you. And I found myself doing, for instance, children's hour things, quite a lot of stuff for children's hour. And that had a spin-off because the Christian Science Monitor of all newspapers happened to pick up on this and asked me to be the editor, the science editor for their weekly children's page, which was rather nice. So I got a worldwide coverage on that. But I was also doing evening programmes, particularly of a rather topical nature. I was a sort of typical radio freelance, picking up small sums of money here, there and everywhere from the BBC, as well as getting on with the job of schoolmastering, which I like very much. When war broke out in 39-40, the BBC, of course, was caught on the hop, because stupid people in the government in preparing for the war had assumed that broadcasting would close down altogether. This is all there in the official records. And even the Prime Minister, Chamberlain, said people won't have any time for it. You know, we close it down. And so all the able-bodied members of the staff of the BBC, the males, were scheduled at once to go off into the armed forces, and did, as soon as war broke out. So the BBC was left with only a skeleton staff. And very soon circumstances indicated that, so far from broadcasting not being required, broadcasting was an absolute necessity in terms of supporting a national morale and all the rest of it, and giving people interests and amusement and relaxation and all the rest of it at a time when they needed it more than normally they did. So, and also, of course, there was an enormous need for the BBC to expand its news services. So, I, as a freelance and as a man who, as I said earlier, had indulged in a fair amount of freelance topicality for the BBC, I was increasingly spending my time at Broadcasting House doing news and current affairs type programming, and particularly interviewing and that sort of thing. And indeed, I had a weekly program of my own called In Britain Now, which was a very striking program indeed. It was on the face of it, it was just a talks magazine kind of program about what life is like in Britain during the war. But we wished to use it in order to show to the world, and particularly to the enemy, that despite all the bombing and the disruption that was going on, there was a large element of normality left in everyday life in Britain. And in particular, and so what we made a special point of doing in this thing called In Britain Now, this weekly magazine, was going to all sorts of outlandish places, switching live from one to another, from the Shetland Islands to the Scillies, to mountaintops, to coal mines, to everywhere about the place, where you would think at the best of times that it was quite an achievement to get a microphone there and to get a link between that place and the broadcasting system. We got in half a dozen of these into every one of these programmes. So in Britain now it was quite an important thing. And there was I doing this lot of broadcasting, and you will remember that there was direction of labour at this time. This was one of the wartime regulations. A person of my age, I was, I suppose, towards my late 20s then, was subject to direction of labour. So that if in fact the Ministry of Labour or its officials decided that I was suitable for war service, into war service I'd go. I had been in a reserved occupation as a schoolmaster, and they weren't going to interfere with me there. But the BBC began making an application for me to get onto the staff as a full-time broadcasting person. I didn't apply to join the BBC. I was directed into the BBC. And when this was first talked about with me, I said that I felt that if I gave up schoolmastering, I really ought to go into the armed services. A chap of my age had no right to dodge that kind of issue, that kind of responsibility. And that I didn't think it was a good option for me to finish up in a comfortable BBC office having a fairly enjoyable life as a broadcaster. The question then put to me by the controller who was interviewing me was, well, what particular job in the BBC do you think would meet your requirements? And I said it was a war correspondent. And he looked at me in amazement and said, but you've never been on a newspaper, you're not a journalist. And I said, well, what is In Britain Now, this My Weekly Program, what's that but journalism? Look at this, I do The World Goes By, I do all these other things. I'm always on the air doing reports and topical stories and that sort of thing. What is that but journalism? I've never been on a newspaper, but that kind of journalism is only common sense anyway. And he was influenced by this, and so in the end they brought me onto the staff. This was 41 now. They brought me onto the staff as a part-time war correspondent, 3 days a week, based in Bristol, serving with the Home Forces of Southern Command, and with the United States forces when they came in, and not only with the Army but also with the Navy and the Air Force. And the other 3 days of the week, because it was a six-day week that one worked at that time, I was to be an ordinary talks producer based in Bristol. That arrangement lasted for, I think, 4 or 5 months, by which time, I think they used it, when I say they, I mean the editorial side of the BBC, I think they used it quite wisely to see whether I was the sort of chap who might become a good war correspondent. And actually, there were hundreds of marvellous stories lying about in Southern Command that nobody else was covering, nobody else was looking at. The preparation and training of the Home Forces for the eventual offensive action that we were going to take, and indeed the training of the forces who were going out to North Africa and all the rest of it. And I became a bit of an expert in all this in no time at all, with great help from the public relations branch of the Army, I must say. I mean, they were simply marvellous to me, because they were digging up stories for me all the time. And even in this part-time period, I was on the air, in news bulletins, time and time again, every week, with fresh material about the training of our forces, about the massing of our forces and so forth, so far as censorship in those days allowed. And so that in no time at all, as I say, 4 months or so, I was moved up to London and made a full-time war correspondent, and based then in London, I went on doing that work and got involved in such things as the Dieppe raid, which was the first time I'd actually ever heard guns fired in anger, and that, of course, was a very frightening experience indeed. I mean, absolutely terrifying, the Dieppe raid. It was a dreadful experience.
Well, what exactly did you do at the Dieppe raid?
I was on a tank landing craft, and we never actually put our craft down, because by the time we were to be called in, it was quite obvious that the battle was lost, so to speak. It was quite obvious that we were being annihilated on the beaches, so we hung about off the beaches, and we hauled back as many as we could of the wounded and the guys who'd been knocked out. We took over 5,000 men, and we brought back 1,250. And that all happened in the space of 4 hours early one August morning, People since made a big fuss about our losses in the Falkland Islands, where we lost 280 people altogether over in a campaign which lasted, what, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, quite a considerable period of time. We lost there, on the beaches of Dieppe, we lost over 1,000 killed, and we lost a further 2,750 men wounded or taken prisoner in 4 hours.
Do you remember anything about the security situation regarding the Dieppe raid before it took place?
Oh, it was absolutely crazy. Absolutely mad. The Dieppe raid was originally planned to take place in June of 1942. And those of us, we are just a very small handful of correspondents, I think half a dozen of us, assigned to cover the operation, went incommunicado, not knowing where we were going to go, and we were whipped off to the Isle of Wight. And the Isle of Wight was sealed off. And there, for 3 weeks, we trained with the force. It was the Canadian 2nd Division or 1st Division, I forget which was to carry out this landing. And none of us knew at the time what the objective was. We just simply were put through 3 weeks of intensive square bashing and told that it was going to be a pretty intensive operation, and that the army could take no passengers. So we had to be fit to look after ourselves. Well, that was fine. That was fair enough, you know, and very good for us. On the evening before the convoy was due to sail for this unknown destination, we were taken to the planning headquarters, and Colonel Churchill Mann of the Canadian Army, he was the head of the intelligence of this Canadian division, briefed us over a model and revealed to us that Dieppe was the objective, and pointed out all the purposes of the operation and painted a most optimistic picture of what a success it was all going to be. It was a raid. It wasn't going to be, there was no question of remaining there. It was a raid. We were going to shake the Germans to their foundations. We were going to destroy all their defensive positions. We were going to blow up their tanks and everything they'd got there. There were 42 German invasion craft in the basin behind the main shoreline at Dieppe. And we were going to tow these back in a triumphant procession across the English Channel at the end of the operation. It was a most glowing and wildly optimistic account of what this operation was going to be. And, of course, we were then sworn to secrecy, and as we left that briefing room, I mean, the half a dozen of us looked at each other in absolute stupor, in amazement, at the very thought that people could deceive themselves to such an extent as to believe that everything was going to go like that, that we were going to knock out every defensive position, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right off. And I remember saying to Bill Armstrong, who was an American, who was the correspondent of the Chicago Sun Life or some such, one of the big Chicago newspapers, I remember saying to him, supposing that we were there, supposing that we were the people defending Dieppe, would we be sitting down and letting this happen? I mean, what would we be doing if an invasion force came into us? I mean, we should be firing every gun we've got. We should be resisting this to the hilt. And they've been there for years, creating these defences. And I mean, he totally agreed with me. Anyway, we're still in June. We went aboard the landing craft the next day. We lay off in the channel. The ship's company were informed of what the operation was going to be all about. So were the ship's companies and all the other ships of the convoy. We hung about there. The weather was bad. The Germans discovered us. They bombed us. Three of our ships in the convoy, three substantial ships, had direct hits. And the weather showed no signs of abating. And so in the end, with our tail between our legs, we came back to the Isle of Wight and we were disbanded. And we went back to our various offices and said, well, no story. Because, of course, we simply we couldn't give any account of what had happened up to then. No censor would ever have passed it. I personally was absolutely stunned when the Dieppe raid was laid on again 6 weeks later. knowing that, something like altogether 16,000 people had been briefed about the Dieppe plan in June. These were all the people, the combined forces taking part in the operation who'd all been briefed while at sea, plus the boys in the air. And, of course, if they knew, everybody in there at the air bases from which they were to fly also knew about it. And it seemed to me to be absolutely the maddest thing I'd ever heard, that an operation of which the Germans must by then have had the fullest detail should be laid on again. And the way in which it was done beggars belief. I've written about this. We got, I remember, because I was the BBC war correspondent who was standing by indefinitely in London for calls. And on a Sunday afternoon, on a Sunday morning, I received a call early to report to the Duke of York's headquarters here in London, with minimum kit, and I expect to be away for some days. So I reported there, and lo and behold, there were the half dozen other people who'd been with me on the Isle of Wight previously. No information was given to us. We were finally put in a staff car, taken to Paddington, and put on a train to Bristol. Which stunned all of us. I mean, where the hell? What on earth was going to happen from Bristol, of all places? Were we going to invade Era, or what? And what made it even more extraordinary was that we were in a reserve compartment with a guard at the door, and during the journey, a public relations officer, Captain Bowles, came into our compartment and said, "Gentlemen, you kindly remove your war correspondent flashes from your shoulder straps, and I'm going to give you temporary commissions." And, you know, our eyes opened wide and said, "This is not on." He said, "Oh, yes, these are my instructions, and you'll kindly follow them out." So when we got off the train in Bristol, we proudly had our pips. And just think, I think I was a major, on our shoulder straps. And we were taken to the Grand Hotel in Bristol. And we were told that under no circumstances must we be identified or identify ourselves, and of course we mustn't communicate with anybody. Now, I've already mentioned that Bristol had been my base in the BBC for some time. I was a fairly well-known person in Bristol. And going into the Grand Hotel, in the hallway, in the lobby of the Grand Hotel, there were people who knew me and came up and looked at my pips. I said, "What's this? What are you doing, Frank? What are you up to?" And I had to say to them, "I'm sorry, I think you're making a mistake." Isn't it incredible? The next day, the Monday, that was a Sunday, spent the night at the Grand Hotel. The next day, we were told, well, we're going to have to remain in Bristol for an indefinite period, but unfortunately the Grand Hotel couldn't accommodate us anymore. So we were to be taken to a private hotel called the Hawthorns at Clifton, which is a suburb of Bristol. This absolutely horrified me, because the Hawthorns is, 100 yards away from the BBC's headquarters in Bristol, where I'd been working previously. And it was the place where, when I was working in Bristol, I had stayed. I'd made my base, my home, you know. And I said, "This is absolutely... I mean, I can't go there without everybody in the BBC knowing about it in 5 minutes. And all sorts of other people. And I should be recognised by all and sundry. It's far better for me to go there and as a war correspondent and simply say, here I am, I'm come down to do a bit more of the sort of work I was doing before when I was here with the boys on Salisbury Plain. Why go through all this silly charade, which is only going to arouse God knows what in the way of suspicions?" The guy running the BBC in Bristol at that time was, in fact, an ex-army officer, colonel of World War I, you know, who would have rumbled things in no time. No, boot-facedly, I was told, "You'll do exactly what we instruct you to do." So I went through all this business again at the Hawthorns Hotel for the next 24 hours. Then on the third day, the Wednesday, we were instructed, after our breakfast, which of course we had in our rooms, to report, to quickly go through the lobby and to board a 3-ton truck which we'd waiting in the road outside, which it was, and get in the back. We didn't know what was going to happen. It took us down to Temple Mead Station, the railway station. This time we were taken to the down line, and it looked as if we were going on to Plymouth. But after a short wait on the platform, we were led away around the back of the station, through the goods yard, areas which I'd never seen before. And there was our friendly three-ton truck waiting. We got in it again. This is absolute God's truth. And we trundled out of Bristol and off through Bath and right out towards Warminster into Wiltshire. And we came to a lay-by or a lane or a side road or something and pulled into it. And Captain Bowles came aboard and said, "Well, gentlemen, now I can tell you what's going to happen. You're incommunicado. You will not have any communication with anybody at all. So I'm free to tell you this. The Dieppe raid is on again. We're taking you to New Haven. You'll reach there by this evening. When we get there, we shall assign you to various landing craft, and you will participate in the raid. And the plans are exactly as they were in June." You know, it was absolutely stunning, the stupidity of it, the sheer, utter, crazy madness. But that's what happened. So we spent the day in this three-ton truck, trundling without any food across southern England. When it got to a sort of tea time, we were starving for food, having had only a light breakfast, and demanded of Bowles that the convoy be halted and that some food be found for us. And he went to some pub or other in the next village that we reached and came back with a small plateful of sandwiches. And I remember, really very small, after all it's food rationing, if you remember. So I remember we had one small sandwich each and a bottle of beer. That was it. We got to New Haven, and he did as he said he would. I mean, kept us under observation all the time, took us into the dockyard, into the harbour at New Haven, and assigned us one at a time to landing craft. I reported to the... I'd never seen it. Well, we none of us seen tank landing craft before. I mean, these sort of landing craft are absolutely new. They were it was the first time that they'd appeared. I went and reported to the commanding officer of this little landing craft, and he said, "Who are you?" And I told him. And he said, "I know nothing about you." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm dumped on you." And he said, "Well, I hope you've brought everything with you." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, we're all on hire. Every man on board's brought his own rations on. You've got your rations, haven't you?" And I said, "No, I haven't any rations." And he said, "Well, too bad then. You'll go hungry." He said, I'll certainly take you, but you've no authority to be here, and please don't interfere with our operations in any way." And that was how we went to Dieppe. We sailed through the night. We set off at dusk. And, of course, by dawn, we were off the French coast. It was clearly visible. I was astonished that there wasn't a heavy bombardment to begin with. But there wasn't. There was a very feeble bombardment, almost a token bombardment. I couldn't imagine how the defences were being softened up. One would have thought there would be heavy naval gunfire to begin with. One would have thought capital ships would have been used to destroy the carefully prepared German defences. They were not at all. Only destroyers with 4-inch guns. And, of course, there was a bit of an air bomb, but not bombers, only fighter bombers, only small bombs. You know, 250-pounders, that sort of thing at the most. And only very few of them. But, of course, as soon as the operations, as soon as the landings began, I stuck by the radio centre in this little landing craft and listened for all I was worth. And, I mean, the reports coming back was, from the beginning, absolutely appalling. And it was quite obvious that there was... not only had we failed in our attempt to land to take the Germans by surprise, it was also quite obvious that we were not adequately armed to deal with all their elaborate defences which they'd prepared. After all, they'd been in occupation of that coastline, don't forget, for a couple of years, which they prepared very carefully. It was quite obvious that we were being annihilated on the beaches. And one after another, the tank landing craft were called in. We didn't know on ours whether we were going to be the next or not. We did know that if we got there, we'd probably never come back again. So we waited in a fair amount of trepidation, for the signal calling us forward. In the end, I didn't land. One or two of my colleagues did, and one of them got a very good story because he was with the commandos who carried out the only successful part of the operation on the western flank and silenced a German coastal defence gun on the cliffs. But the rest of us, instantly we were armed, which we all objected to very strongly, because you know that the rules of warfare are that war correspondents like chaplains don't carry arms. And if you are taken prisoner and you're found to be armed, you're immediately shot as a franc-tireur. And we objected to carrying arms. Nevertheless, it was insisted upon, and I was armed. But in fact, what one did, as I expect you'll understand, is, and we spent all our time hauling chaps out of the water from small boats, which had managed to bring them off the beaches, and they were there. They were bleeding, limbs torn away, and that sort of thing, and hauling them on board our landing craft, which was less vulnerable. And when we were full and couldn't find room for anybody else, you know, we got the order to sail back. We were under air attack the whole time. But fortunately for us, nothing hit us. There, lots of our tank landing craft went down. I mean, any number of them were lost that day. We were fortunate. We had lots of near misses, but we weren't struck. We got back early evening. A very, very sorry story. We were met by the Commander-in-Chief of Combined Operations, Admiral Sir Louis Mountbatten, for whom thereafter I never had a single shred of respect, looking as if he'd just stepped out of Gives in his smart white naval uniform, who invited us into his office or whatever it was. We came back to Portsmouth, and then tried very hard to bamboozle us into presenting a very favourable picture of the operation, that the lessons had been learnt which would enable us next time to make an effective landing and so forth. And there were we, plastered in mud all over our battle dress uniforms, and Louis Mountbatten, as I say, looking almost like a tailor's dummy, and quite oblivious to the kind of stories that we had to tell him. We didn't want to hear them. And as Montgomery said subsequently, it was a great pity that so many Canadian lives had to be lost in order to teach us things that we knew already. But it was a terrible, terrible incident and a great blot on military history, I'm afraid.
Was it after this that you went to North Africa?
Yes, after that. I just finished by saying that there was, of course, extreme censorship applied to the reports where any of us were allowed to print or broadcast about the Deer Parade. Nothing. We were not allowed to say anything for 24 hours. And even then, the facts we were allowed to reveal were... we could not in any way indicate that the operation had been a failure. Not a word of that kind was permitted. We were expected to... I concentrated on the air battle, which, of course, I'd be...